Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
I'm going to be reading this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, chapter 6, verses 9-12. Chapter 6 is Purusha Sukta confirmed. What's the subject matter of Purusha Sukta? That's a question. That requires an answer. We'll back up. What is Purusha Sukta? Back up. Where does Purusha Sukta come from? Okay. Purusha Sukta are prayers that come from the Rig Veda. The Purusha Sukta prayers are standard prayers that are recited at auspicious occasions. One example of Purusha Sukta prayers being recited is when the demigods went to the shore of the Milk Ocean to offer prayers to the Personality of Godhead. They were glorifying him through the Purusha Sukta prayers. And the Srimad Bhagavatam here is making a commentary on Purusha Sukta prayers, and it's called Purusha Sukta Confirmed. Just like the Srimad Bhagavatam is said to be a commentary on Vedanta Sutra, right? Commentary on Vedanta Sutra. And for that reason, Vaishnavas, followers of Lord Chaitanya, made no commentary on Vedanta Sutra because they considered Srimad Bhagavatam was that commentary. What else is Srimad Bhagavatam a commentary on? As the Purusha Sukta prayers are standard Vedic Rig Veda mantras, so also Gayatri Mantra, standard Vedic mantras. Srimad Bhagavatam is a commentary on Vedanta, on Gayatri Mantra. And our acharyas have detailed how it is that Srimad Bhagavatam is a commentary on Gayatri. There are some people that think all kinds of things. There are some people that think that Gayatri Mantra is worship of the sun. Some people think that Gayatri Mantra is worship of impersonal Brahman. Some people think all kinds of things. So how do we understand Gayatri Mantra? Srimad Bhagavatam explains it. Even starting right within the first verse of the first canto. Their glorification of the Personality of Godhead. In the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam, Jiva Goswami points this out, that this word, Dhimahi, that's found in Gayatri Mantra, has a very specific application. Dhimahi, in a general sense, is I meditate upon. But we have so many words in Sanskrit for meditate upon. Just like in the Ashtanga Yoga system, Dhyan, Dharana, and Samadhi, there's three. And Manmana, that's another one. Dhimahi is very specific. It's a classic term. And Satyam Param Dhimahi appears in the first verse. It's the closing line of the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's Satyam Param, the highest truth we meditate upon. And we met the highest truth, Janmadiyasya Yataha. The highest truth is that from which everything else, the existence of everything else is based upon, from which it comes. That's the highest truth. The Vedanta Sutra and Gayatri Mantra are both being indicated right from the very beginning. Okay, so now Purusha Sukta, we know where it comes from. It's from the Rig Veda, certain prayers. Sukta means prayers, a certain type of prayer. And what's the subject of Purusha Sukta? Any volunteers? The a hint is Purusha Sukta. Okay. What are the Purusha avatars? Purusha avatars are expansions or avatars of the Lord for the purpose of material creation. It's a function of the Supreme Lord for the purpose of material creation. So even more specifically, the Purusha Sukta prayers are glorifying an expansion of the Purusha avatars, which is the universal form, Virat Rupa. In this second canto, this very enigmatic topic, the universal form, is spoken of a lot. There are two full chapters out of eight chapters that speak about it. And if anybody thinks that they can very easily explain the universal form, I'd like to hear it. The universal form is difficult to understand. Although it's material, it should be easier to understand than transcendence. It's like closer to us. Than transcendence. The universal form is in chapter 1 of canto 2 is presented by Shukadev Goswami as basically it's a means for those who have no conception of God to form one, to form a personal conception of God through seeing God within nature, because they see nature, so they may not be able to see God. When you see that part of nature and that part of nature, see those parts of nature in relation to God. Form a God conception. It's passed over and explicitly, Shukadeva Goswami says, you can leave that behind. He doesn't say that about the form of Shyamasundar or other transcendental non-different than the personality of Godhead aspects of him. So it's difficult to understand. Here, But the universal form is described in terms of the particular parts of the universal form's body. Well, let's say this, or ask this. What is the universal form? If it's an expansion of the Purusha avatars, what's the relation? What's the function of the universal form? Chapter 11, Bhagavad Gita. What's the function? Certainly, it's one. Brings everything into being also. It's the form of the Lord that makes up this universe. That's what the universal form is. So it's everything. Everything of the material creation at once. That is a form of the Lord. Its function is manifesting and Purusha avatars, Lord Vishnu, maintain and it destroys. It's like a blueprint for those who have to make something that's very intricate and complicated. An architect makes a drawing and then there's a blueprint and then the contractor, the construction guy, follows the blueprint, and from the blueprint he makes the concept manifest in the form of a building or a car or a whatever it is that's being built. So it's the subtle form of that which becomes grossly manifest. So I'm reading sequentially verses that are describing the universal form and functions of the parts of the universal form, the bodily parts of the universal form. And I got up to, well, it describes the arms and the feet and the legs, and different things are said about them. Now it's at the back of the Lord, the impersonal feature of the Lord, and the consciousness of the Lord. It described just previously the generating organ, the genitals of the Lord. Then the evacuating outlet of the universal form of the Lord is the abode of the controlling deity of death, Mitra. And the evacuating hole and the rectum of the Lord is the place of envy, misfortune, death, hell, etc. There's no purport for that verse. The back of the Lord is the place for all kinds of frustration and ignorance, as well as for immorality. From his veins flow the great rivers and rivulets, and on his bones are stacked the great mountains. Purport. In order to defy the impersonal conception of the Supreme Personality of God, it is systematic analysis of the physiological and anatomical constitution of his transcendental body is given here. It is clear from the available description of the body of the Lord, parentheses, his universal form, that the form of the Lord is distinct from the forms of ordinary mundane conception. In any case, he is never a formless void. That's the most important part to understand from all of this. Prabhupada emphasizes this at times throughout the whole section. Ignorance is the back of the Lord, and therefore the ignorance of the less intelligent class of men is also not separate from his bodily conception. Since his body is the complete whole of everything that be, one cannot assert that he is impersonal only. On the contrary, the perfect description of the Lord holds that he is both impersonal and personal simultaneously. The personality of Godhead is the original feature of the Lord, and his impersonal emanation is but the reflection of his transcendental body. Those who are fortunate enough to have a view of the Lord from the front can realize his personal feature, whereas those who are frustrated and are thus kept on the ignorance side of the Lord, or in other words, those who have a view of the Lord from the back, realize him in his impersonal feature. Prabhupada is moving very quickly through Bhagavan conception and Brahman conception as the personal and impersonal conception, and then comparing those two to the front side and the back side of the universal form. Now, one is clearly transcendental, both Bhagavan and Brahman conception. There are transcendental conceptions. Of course, there's material conceptions of the transcendental form of the Lord, and there's material conceptions of the impersonal feature of the Lord. But universal form has eyes, genitals, hair, feet, legs, arms. So his backside, where one can't see all these things so clearly, or one sees them in an impersonal way. Something that Prabhupada repeated many times is that things that are of this world cannot exist except that they have their spiritual counterpart. From where does anger come? From where does anything come? It has its place in the spiritual realm. And here, that thing which has its place in the spiritual realm is manifested in a distorted, perverted form. But the existence is in the Supreme. And what's needed, because that's true, what's needed is simply to purify. I was listening the other day to Prabhupada give an explanation to someone about forget the exact subject, but on the theme, on the same theme, where does such and such come from? So Prabhupada took their question and turned it around. How can such and such exist? How can anything exist unless that anything has its source in the Supreme? Like the living entity's forgetfulness. Here, the living entity's forgetfulness or ignorance. We know from chapter 15 of Bhagavad Gita, the source of knowledge is the same as the source of forgetfulness. From the Supersoul. And depending upon how the living entity regards the Supreme, there's ignorance or there's knowledge. There's remembrance or there's forgetfulness. It's all a matter of our relationship with the Supreme. So if there's forgetfulness and there's ignorance, in terms of the universal form, not in terms of super soul, but in terms of the universal form, that's the backside. Those who are frustrated and are thus kept on the ignorant side of the Lord, or in other words, who have the view of the Lord from the back, realize Him in His impersonal feature. I mean, at best. And their disposition is also impersonal, as opposed to the far more refined and subtle disposition of one who is personal or realized in the personal feature of the Lord. That continues text 11. The impersonal feature of the Lord is the abode of great oceans, and His belly is the resting place for the materially annihilated living entities. His heart is the abode of the subtle material bodies of the living beings. Thus it is known by the intelligent class of men. I guess that includes us, because this is difficult. Purport. In Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8, texts 17-18, it is stated that according to human calculation, one day of Lord Brahma is equal to 1,000 ages of 4 millenniums, or 4,300,000 years each. And the same period is calculated to be his night also. A Brahma who lives for 100 such years and then dies. A Brahma who is generally a great devotee of the Lord attains liberation after such a fall down. The universe, called Brahmanda, or the round football-like domain controlled by a Brahma, the universe is thus annihilated, and thus the inhabitants of a particular planet or the whole universe are also annihilated. Avyakta, mentioned here in this verse, means the night of Brahma, when partial annihilation takes place in the living entities of that particular Brahmanda up to the planets of Brahmaloka, along with the big oceans, etc., all repose in the belly of Virat Purusha. They have to go somewhere. At the end of Brahma's night, the creation again takes place, and the living entities reserved within the belly of the Lord are let loose to play their respective parts as if being awakened from a deep slumber. Since the living entities are never destroyed, the annihilation of the material world does not annihilate the existence of the living entities. But until liberation is attained, one has to accept one material body after another again and again. The human life is meant for making a solution to this repeated change of bodies and thereby attaining a place in the spiritual sky, where everything is eternal, blissful, and full of knowledge. In other words, the subtle form of the living entities take place in the heart of the Supreme Being. Read that again. In other words, the subtle forms of the living entities take place in the heart of the Supreme Being, and such forms take tangible shape at the time of creation. Oh, so, so clear. The belly of the Lord and the heart of the Lord and the impersonal feature of the Lord. Well, these great, this impersonal feature is where it's during the night of Brahma, the time of partial annihilation, there's no activity or personality, individuality is suspended. Material feature of individuality is suspended. You know, like, I'm a this and I'm that and all the upadis, like there's nothing, there's no covering there. So, that's the sense of impersonal in this case. It's where the whole affair of creation is at rest. Everything is, the elements are withdrawn. The bodies and the elements that compose the bodies, they're withdrawn into a subtle, unmanifest state. That's the great oceans. And the belly, that's where the living entities go, within the body of the Lord. It's very mysterious. It's in one sense it's easier to conceive of all of this in terms of Mahapurusha, Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshay Vishnu, and Sharadakshay Vishnu. Because the elements go within the body of Mahavishnu, and when he breathes, the elements through his exhaling are they're the ingredients for the formation of the universes, which then expand because Garbhadakshay Vishnu is there entering into the universe to expand them. Anyway, the belly is the resting place of the living entities. The word avyakta in the verse is translated as the impersonal feature. Avyakta rasa sindhu nam. Rasa sindhu nam. The oceans and seas of water. Avyakta rasa sindhu nam, the impersonal feature. In the purport, Prabhupada is saying this word of vyakta refers to the night of Brahma. So, you know, vyakta, personal. Avyakta, impersonal. Variety, apparently no variety, or with the withdrawal of variety. That's the impersonal sense here, not, you know, the Brahma Jyoti, impersonal. The lack of variegatedness, the absence of variegatedness. For that matter, the absence of anything, because it's avyakta, in a dormant state. The elements go from a dormant to a manifest, avyakta, vyakta. And the living entities enter within the belly of the Lord at that time. And then they come out when it's time for the next day of Brahma. And then as far as the heart, here's what it says. I'll read it again. The subtle forms of the living entities take place in the heart of the Supreme Being, and such forms take tangible shape at the time of creation. Well, this for sure would can be taken as a statement against Darwinian evolution. That subtle forms exist even before the forms exist. You know, there's so many varieties of species. How do those varieties of species come into being? Darwin has one idea. The other idea is they're existing during the avyakta state in a subtle aspect. And that subtle aspect becomes grossly manifested by Lord Brahma. That's his service. He takes the ingredients which are in their unmanifested state, and by the arrangement of the Lord, they become manifest, and he takes those ingredients and designs or creates bodies according to the subtle feature. And within limitation, even during our lifetime, configurations of matter are in part determined by the state of mind. When somebody is devastated by something and their mind is just like disconsolate, configurations of matter of their body changes, and vice versa. So subtle affects gross. The girl was giving her examples of that program last night. Text 12 will complete our verses for this morning. Also, the consciousness of that great personality is the abode of religious principles, mine, yours, and those of the four bachelors, Sanaka, Sanatana, Sanat Kumar, and Sanandana. That consciousness is also the abode of truth and transcendental knowledge. The abode of religion, religious principles, and the abode of truth and transcendental knowledge. No purport. Sometimes the Virat Rupa is described as imaginary. And imaginary in the sense of there's different, you know, there's one sense of imaginary is that it's impermanent. Anything that's impermanent is imaginary, in contrast to that which is permanent and therefore is of substance. So, like anything. Anything that exists, this nice little folding table, we can say it's imaginary. It's not imaginary in the sense that it's not holding up the Tulsi plant. It's just, we're just imagining that it's holding up the Tulsi plant. But it's imaginary in the sense that it's impermanent. after some time, it won't be standing there holding up the tulsi plant. It will be some in some other state of existence, the elements that comprise it. So we can say, Bhumi Rapo Nalo Vayu. We can say that. That's what it is. But with a certain configuration, then it has a function. And that certain configuration was before it was a table, it was an idea. And then there were elements, like wood. And it was made into a table. So bodies are like, forms of life are like that too. There's an idea. It's the Lord's conception. You can't get species without the Lord's conceiving their species, conceiving of them. And then there's, you know, this, it's not a one-way program, it's a two-way program. It's a relationship where the living entities have desires. And then the Lord reciprocate, they have, it starts with the desire for independent enjoyment from the Lord. Which the Lord reciprocates with. And when that independent, subtle desire, subtle aspect of existence presents itself or manifests itself, then bodies manifest themselves, or forms manifest themselves. But then there's religious and irreligious, just like the backside is irreligion, and the consciousness of the Lord is the abode of religious principles. So as the overall thing that Prabhupada is saying in all of this is, as we see things in relation to the Lord, you can see it in terms of the universal form, or you can see it in terms of matter coming from the Purusha avatars, just like, you know, the chapter 2 of Canto 1 moves from the universal form to the Lord of the heart. And then it moves from the Lord of the heart to Bhagavan conception, and the relationship of loving exchange with the Supreme. So that's a lot easier than this impersonal universal form. And Prabhupada very quickly takes it to the Bhagavan feature. To the purpose of outlining all of this is to help us make a clear transition or it's two things. So we can make a, without slipping, we can move from our state of contaminated consciousness to Supreme Consciousness without just making leaps of assumptions. With blind faith. Like that student was saying last night about accepting that there's a conscious self, that the Atma being the conscious self, as opposed to, you know, the different parts collectively making up consciousness, the parts of gross and subtle matter making up consciousness. I wasn't really clear. At this moment, I'm not really clear all of what he was asking. If he was asking as simple as, you know, why not, as opposed to why, with all the why nots were already given, or a number of why nots were already given. A why is, well, you know, where's the proof that this is the way that it really is instead of some other way? And it's not a proof that there is some other way. It's a Vedic model of consciousness interacting with gross and subtle matter. And in one sense, one can look at Virat Rupa, the way that this is described, as like that also. How do we know that the universal form exists? Have we ever seen one? What's our experience of the universal form? But in the first chapter, it's presented as a step to help one come to a personal conception. So that's the other function, help one come to a personal conception. A conception of God as a person. Because in some parts of the world, in China, for example, there isn't one. I was asking some Chinese people. There's so many millions and millions. I don't know what the population of China is today. Huh?
Almost
2 billion.
Almost. I don't know exactly, but around there.
Around there. So that's a lot of millions. And I said, you know, with all these people, what keeps them from being, you know, criminal and bad? What holds together their, you know, ethics? And the answer I got was tradition. And I said, well, if that's all that you have going for you, or if that is the thing that you have going, as strong as tradition is, modernity is going to destroy all that. The prosperity of India, excuse me, the prosperity of China is bringing in modernism. It's bringing in, you know, imitations of everything. That's, although they have the tradition. So that the government very much values prosperity, but they also value, you know, keeping peace. And so one of the ways that they do it is anybody steps out of the line, they really get whacked. But that's like fear. It's not, you know, that there has to be another fabric besides fear. And the fabric that they have is tradition. My point was, without God, without a God, you know, if the government was smart, it would understand you have to have God. But then they look at the rest of the world and say, look at the rest of the world has God, and they're a mess. We don't want that mess. So unruly. But it's not just God is the cause of unruliness, it's the modernity that's the cause of the unruliness, the absence of God. Hey, we got a situation of the absence of God, but we're doing fine. Leave us alone. Because the God concept is the basis of morality. Otherwise, why be moral? And for that matter, what is moral? Today's immorality is tomorrow's morality. You know, things that are going on in the modern context is, you know, it's one of those things that's just like a traditional joke. You know, the grandfather looks at the grandchildren, the way that they live, the two generations later, and they're shocked at their standards of behavior. And it keeps going on, it keeps going on, it keeps going on. The next two generations later think, oh my God, look at what they're doing. Look at how they're dressing, and look at how they're speaking, and how they're behaving, and how they're eating. McDonald's is proliferating all over the place. And it doesn't have a zero effect. on deterioration of as the sense of what's moral and what's immoral. Anyway, so the consciousness of that great personality is the abode of religious principles. Mine, yours, and those of the four Kumaras, that consciousness is also the abode of truth and transcendental knowledge. So somehow this very difficult to understand, subtle, impermanent universal form has some role to play in our lives, our conditional lives and in our transcendental lives. So it presented. Go back and say it's the subject matter of the Purusha Sukta prayers, universal form, and how the universe comes into being, how Brahma comes into being, how the Varna and Ashram system comes into being, the different divisions of occupation and orders of life. So it's the universal form. It's something like an agent of the Purusha avatars, specifically for the purpose of creation of variegatedness and material function. The highest of the material function is to get out of the cycle of birth and death. Fortunately, our getting out of the cycle of birth and death is not dependent upon our understanding of the universal form. We'd be in difficult shape if that was the case. But at least, you know, the understanding that all things that exist come from the Supreme Lord. That's needed. And how that is, that higher technology is here in this chapter 6. There are certain verses out of the second canto that I haven't spoken on, and this is one of them, and one of the reasons is they're so intricate. They're not fun verses. But, you know, I'm just finishing up canto 2, so you got the opportunity to hear some of those more difficult verses. Okay. Any comments or discussion on this? Yeah.
You had mentioned that the material feature of independence was...
Material feature of the...
Of independence. Like, could you explain a little more what you meant by that?
The material feature of independence?
Yes. I mean, is it different?
Is there a spiritual feature of independence?
Because, as I understand it, like, independence as in we're not one with the Supreme.
Yeah. We have individuality in the spiritual realm. And with that individuality, we have our spiritual freedom. Mm-hmm. We have our relationship with... It's spontaneously there, but we have our... You know, freedom to act in our relationship with Krishna in a loving way. There are varieties of choices that the living entities make in their loving relationship with Krishna. The difference between material, this was the point that Prabhupada was making, the difference between material and spiritual is just, it's simply a matter of being in one's relationship with Krishna or not. And it's not a matter of lip service, it's in fact being in one's relationship with Krishna. I mean, I can say I'm a religious person and do things that have nothing to do with what a religious person really would do, but I think, you know, I can say I'm a religious person. It's not just a matter of professing something. I accept Christ as my Lord and Savior, and I do anything I like. And the material sense of independence is the misuse of that. It's an illusory sense of that, because we're not independent. But the spiritual sense of independence is, in my relationship with Krishna, there's varieties of ways that I have for serving Krishna. Yes.
Sometimes the Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is referred to as Hiranyagarbha.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've understood that to be the universal form also. Can you explain the difference between these?
Hiranyagarbha, this is as the... No, I can't. Hiranyagarbha term is because it's the golden egg, and the golden egg, that universe is as a golden egg, Hiranya, golden, Garbha. So it's he enters into that golden egg and expands it. The use of Hiranyagarbha as the universal form, I've not seen that. I'll take your word for it. I mean, it doesn't register.
Yeah, it's a confusion that's
quite... Yeah, I can't confirm. I can't say it otherwise either, but I can't confirm that Hiranyagarbha is sometimes used to refer to the Virat Rupa.
Because it seems if he's expanding the universe, he's expanding the universal form. That's that type of concern.
Okay, well... Then, you know, what you're asking then, what's the relationship between Garbhodakshaya Vishnu and the universal form? Whether the terminology is the same or not. It's the form of the Lord in the universe as opposed to Garbhodakshaya Vishnu who is residing within the universe. And because of his presence, his spiritual presence, he's expanding, just like Prabhupada's example, by the presence of the soul within the body, within a mother's womb, because of the presence of the soul, the body grows. Similarly, by the presence of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, the universe grows. And the form of the universe is the universal form. That which is growing. Due to the presence of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, the soul of the universe. Okay? Something?
So is the universal form mentioned here in the second canto, is it similar to, is it related with, is it different from the universal form mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna displays?
It's similar but different. The term is the same. How the universal form is depicted in chapter 11, Bhagavad Gita, is different. But it's still the universal form. The universal form in Canto 1 is the same term but different. The universal form in Canto 1 is referring more to that which you see in nature, pantheism. And in Bhagavad Gita, it's the demigods and the planets and living entities and, you know, moving here and there. So many faces, so many arms. But, you know, how can you describe the totality of everything in a few verses? It's the universal form, or a feature of the universal form.
Considered imaginary in a sense?
Yes. Imaginary in the sense of temporary, not imaginary in the other kind of sense. imaginary that, you know, now you see it, now you don't. Vyakta and avyakta. But it is a form. At the same time it's imaginary, it's one of the forms of the Lord. It's not imaginary in the sense that it doesn't exist. Someone just kind of stood on their head too long and came up with this imaginary notion. You have something? No? Anyone? Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.